Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in Library Science podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael LaMagna. Today, I'm joined by the author of The Discourse of Scholarly Communication, published in 2023 by Roman and Littlefield. This book examines topics like disciplinary boundaries, the production and producers of scholarship, the connectedness of content and forms, and the role of libraries and archives as the stewards of scholarship through the lens of the Enlightenment. Joining me to discuss this book is the author, Patrick Gamsby, the scholarly communication librarian and cross-appointed to the Department of Sociology at Memorial University of Newfoundland. Welcome to the podcast, Patrick.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael.
Excellent. So before we begin and discuss your book, The Discourse of Scholarly Communication, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and your path into academic librarianship.
I was a sociology student at the University of Western Ontario as an undergrad, and I was a research assistant for one of my jobs, and I also worked in the interlibrary loans department at the main library there, and I thought, you know, I'm doing a lot of research, this is great, how can I do more? I can get a job in the library. So from my undergrad, I went on at the same school and did my master's of library and information science. And so I also kept taking sociology courses, grad level courses. And I thought, you know, if I'm to be any kind of librarian, it's an academic one. And, you know, it doesn't take that long in library school for you to find out that you need oftentimes additional degrees, at least in the humanities and social sciences, if you want to be an academic librarian. So from there, I went to York University and did a master's in environmental studies. And I thought, you know, if I don't keep going at this point, I'll never do it. And so I decided to do my PhD at Laurentian right after that. And then from there, I was living in the United States at the time and started working at Duke University in scholarly communications. I got my start there working with Kevin Smith in scholarly communications there, and he really showed me the way of that particular area of specialization. And then from there, I started working at Brandeis University, also in scholarly communications, before coming home here to Canada, albeit in a different province from where I'm from, to work at Memorial University of Newfoundland. And I recently became cross-appointed, and somewhere along the way, I wrote that book.
That's great. And so we could see that path into scholarly communication and what led you to this publication. So I have to say, I found the structure of your book really approachable. But I have to ask, why did you choose to start your book with a discussion of the Enlightenment? And how does this content, how does this connect with your topic of scholarly communication?
What I was going for there was take something abstract and over the progression of the book, make it much more concrete to a book on the library shelf, actually. So Enlightenment, ultra abstract in a certain sense, but that is something that people are confronted with in when they first start out in universities with mottos of various schools. It's either explicit or implicit that you will be enlightened if you, you know, darken the doorways here and attend. So for me, it goes back to my interest and studies in sociology, where thinking, you know, when did social theory kind of start? And, you know, I teach social theory here at Memorial. I started at the Enlightenment, really. And so, you know, everything's kind of swirling around. What if I had started at the Enlightenment with scholarly communication? What then? And it made a lot of sense to do so with the philosophes or encyclopedists, as they're called alternately, especially Denis Diderot and Jean-Laurent d'Alembert, who are the editors of the big encyclopedia project known as the Encyclopédie. Now, when I worked at Brandeis, they actually had a copy of that there. Now, a copy of the many, many volumes of it. And they're big. They're amazing. If anyone can get their hands on those, they absolutely should. And the idea there predates Wikipedia. They were trying to capture all of the knowledge of the world at the time. And that is different from other encyclopedia projects because there was a political bent to it as well. They really wanted to change how people thought, which I think is usually the mission of a university as well, or you're not getting your money's worth if something doesn't happen along the way there. So really burrowing into the topic of the Enlightenment made a lot of sense. And I, you know, go back and talk about Descartes and Kant and all those fun people everybody knows and loves. I'm just kidding. But Kant, you know, answered the question, what is enlightenment? And it is essentially, you know, humanity's exit from self-incurred minority. And the motto of the Enlightenment is have the courage to use your own reason. And this fits exactly with what a university is supposed to do. And so with the Enlightenment, I'm kind of starting at an ideological level, the level of the university, before, you know, making my way down to things like authorship and then the library and archive, that kind of thing. So starting big and abstract and then whittling down to the book on the shelf, as I said, or a document in an archival box, something like that. Yeah.
So in the title of your book, you use the term discourse. Why is this term so important to your argument of how scholars communicate?
Yeah, I, you know, discourse has so many meanings. We don't, I would argue, we don't really know what is meant when that term is used, but it's a fancy term bandied about in academia. It sounds cool, at least to me. But really, burrowing into its definition specifically with the work of Michel Foucault, which he referred to it as variously, silent murmur, which really resonated with me. It could be perceived as paradoxical, but let's put that to the side. A silent murmur being, you know, how certain mores and norms of the academia as an institution become adopted, become replicated, reproduced, so on and so forth. So to me, the discourse of scholarly communication is all of the things that people generally talk about with scholarly communication, such as open access, say research repositories, copyright, author rights, things of that nature. So all of those well-known things in the field of scholarly communication, at least in the library world, but then the other side of things from, you know, what isn't often talked about, you know, what lies beneath, such as the ideology of the Enlightenment that is behind a lot of things that go on there. Even something like publish or perish, that's a well-known phrase, but there isn't a lot of work on that. It's just one of those known things that needs to happen, but you won't find it in, say, a collective agreement for instructions to, you know, tenure track faculty or even tenured faculty going for promotion, that really publisher perish is something that's known, discussed widely, written about seldomly, and is at the heart of scholarly communications in a lot of ways, where there is a preference for the written word above all else. And one of the things I do is look at Michel Foucault's lectures, which were, although they're published and it is it ticks the box for a printed text, the printed word. It is him speaking to people both in a seminar as well as a lecture. He had two versions of, you know, what he did. I think that's something to keep in mind, really, is that although we do focus so much on the written word as part of the discourse, that's one of the rules of what we do. The lecturing side of things, the advising side of things are extremely important, and they're often in the shadow of the written word. And that's known, but at the same time, not really explored.
Yeah. So you talk about, and I think typically that discourse is disciplinary based, right? And so yeah, we know that it's higher education, it's very siloed in that regard. But you have an interesting conversation about interdisciplinary research. And so, and as you note, that's one of those hot topics, buzzwords that's thrown about quite a bit. It was probably a little bit more popular a few years ago than today. But can you tell me a little bit about interdisciplinary, how it's defined, and then how would you contrast that to, say, multidisciplinary?
Yeah, so something like interdisciplinarity, the most basic definition, which an author named Julie Thompson Klein, who's written several books on the topic, is quick to point out, is the integration of two or more disciplines. And that could mean a variety of different things. But really, it's the integration of two or more sub-disciplines, because as everyone knows who studied any kind of discipline, the more you study it, the more specific you get, and the less you get into other areas of specialization. In a way, you could almost become unaware of them or blind to them in some way. And so interdisciplinarity is that integration, the bringing together, whereas multidisciplinary is almost a juxtaposition or contrast of various disciplines. So you could take a course with, say, a biology professor, a philosophy professor, a sociology professor on climate change, and you would get a different angle in which to look at that topic. And interdisciplinarity would bring all of those perspectives together, almost not necessarily solve. It would be great if you could solve that problem, but tackle the issue together. So it's a very different way of looking at it, but those terminologies, interdisciplinarity, multidisciplinarity, those are thrown around almost as if they're synonyms for one another. But the majority of my focus in the second chapter of the book is on interdisciplinarity and the interconnectedness of knowledge, which that's the title of the chapter, actually.
Yeah, it is. But what was interesting about that chapter is you're talking about interdisciplinary research, and you're pairing it up with open access. And I know our audience is probably familiar with the term open access, being that we're geared towards those in library science. But can you discuss that connection between open access, interdisciplinary research, and then pair it up with maybe closed access models? And why is this conversation important for scholarly communication?
Sure. Yeah. One thing that I found interesting while working on the book is with regards to open access. It's a term that's been used for a long time. Like it's in the five laws of library science. There's some connective tissue between it and how we use it now, which is in the digital world, even using the internet. Anyone with an internet connection can access the material, which is often a PDF of scholarship. That's a and there aren't really any copyright restrictions to it. That's I'm paraphrasing Peter Suber's definition of it in his book Open Access. So open access itself, the concept of it has existed for a long time, and you can see it in public libraries, bringing people in. It's just facilitated and so much easier to both understand and access these days with the internet. So as far as interdisciplinarity goes, when you have open access literature out there, you know, just thinking of journal articles where, say, when I was working on this book, if I didn't have access to Michel Foucault's lectures, I wouldn't have written about them. It's very simple. I wouldn't be able to integrate that into my work. And the same goes for any discipline. Collections librarians certainly know that budgets are limited and you can't buy everything. And you can only provide so much to the users of your library. And so in a certain sense, it's best if there's some kind of collective collecting out there where we're able to make things available from various institutions and yet being able to access them in a way that doesn't stress the interlibrary loans department, which I know that's tough because I worked there many moons ago, as I said before. But really, the connection between the two for me is that the more open access literature is available, the more there are, the greater chance there are for interdisciplinary connections. And it is something as simple as using Google. Somebody just stumbles upon it. Now, the same thing can happen in the stacks. And I encourage people to still use those, absolutely. But yeah, when people can access materials, that leads to all kinds of potential for innovation. That's basically the crux of what I'm going for with that.
Absolutely. And again, it goes to the whole model here of working towards the public good and public education, right? To make sure that content is open access. So in your third chapter, you're exploring the production of scholarship. And I really liked your discussion of peer review and the peer review process. So why is that important to the production of scholarship?
Yeah, well, peer review is one of the pillars of scholarship. But it's so funny because who among us has really been trained to become a peer reviewer? Not me. It just kind of happens. You get a certain degree and suddenly you are magically able to review a peer in a really professional way. So as one of the pillars, you know, you think about it for facilitating scholarly communication, the gatekeeping aspect of it, this is true scholarship, this is not, this needs to be refined, so on and so forth. But for those of you that have done peer review, you know that it isn't always a pleasant experience. There's lots of horror stories out there. And there's good peer review, which really that's a way to enlighten the author or authors of a piece, which helps enlighten the readers of it after it's published. So it's a really a credit to whatever profession, faculty, librarian, whatever, to provide good peer review. You're helping each other that way. You're helping further knowledge. Bad peer review also happens where people don't read the material at all. Now, they may just pass it along and, you know, check the box, yes, this is fine for publication, or, you know, offer some pithy comments for improvement in this area, which doesn't really help the material at all. And then there's ugly peer review where something happens, it seems, in someone's life and they need to take it out on the scholarship that's in front of them, and that no one enjoys that when you're on the receiving end, certainly, and hopefully people strive to not do that as peer reviewers. But it's really a mixed bag of peer review. And I mentioned the fourth option, which is without peer review, and that was a reference in particular to the Sokal affair, Alan Sokal, who is a scientist who ended up writing a piece called Transgressing the Boundaries, and there's a big long title to it, for a journal called Social Text, which was very much a postmodern, more humanist type of journal in the 90s. And it didn't have peer review. And so he kind of put it in there as like a Trojan horse of sorts. And it was published. And once it was published, he said, aha, it's complete gobbledygook. It was nonsense. I fooled you all, so on and so forth. And I think that was part of a Science Wars special publication. And so really that just furthered the war, sparked the debate of, you know, what is the value of humanities? What is the value of social science? Science, you know, what is it to be scientific? What is peer review? In a certain sense, it was good because it kept the debate going. But in another sense, it was really harmful to, you know, the well-intentioned people of social text who welcomed them with open arms. That's a path to cynicism for sure, if that happens to you. But yeah, peer review, it's everywhere in the scholarly communication process, but it's seldomly taught, seldomly explored outside of the parameters offered by a particular publisher. So I think there's more work to be done in certainly changing the peer review process as far as education goes, as far as, you know, ethics go, as far as humanity goes, and just being kind to one another.
And we know about those controversies where people try to submit those fraudulent journal articles to kind of show the flaw of the system. And I think you're hitting on a great point. As a peer reviewer myself, there was no training. It was, you know, start the process. Where do you think that lies? Does it lie with the graduate programs? Does it lie with the publishers? Where should that fall? Or even a professional association?
Yeah, well, all of the above would be good. A variety of takes on it. But I think right now we're kind of leaving it to the publisher, not to train necessarily, but in a certain sense, because there's the review form that you would get. And this kind of dictates, you know, what you are to say about it and the categories you use. But I think it would be really beneficial if it was taught in grad school. Now, this does happen sometimes. Didn't happen for me, I know that, in any of my grad degrees. But for example, here in the sociology department, there's a graduate seminar, and that type of topic does come up. I don't believe it's taught in it's not a training session, but it's, you know, discussed at the very least. That was very much a silent murmur in my graduate training. It was mentioned, but not much was discussed about it. So I would say, you know, if it could be part of a graduate school curriculum, that would do wonders for ameliorating the peer review archipelago. I don't even know what you would call it. Wasteland. Various descriptions could be used depending on what you're asked to do. But I would say probably grad school, but associations can certainly have sessions at conferences. I like to put it more in the hands of the scholars as opposed to the publishers necessarily, although that there may be some intertwinement there. If, you know, the scholar is the editor of a journal, then the journal is the publisher, so on and so forth. So yeah.
And this worked well with your discussion of the production of knowledge, because you're talking about open access and peer review, and you brought in the idea of predatory publishers. And so how does that fit in this conversation?
Yeah, well, predatory publishers would essentially be without editors, without peer review, any of those things that make scholarship have some kind of quality check on it. The peer review doesn't really happen. The editing doesn't happen. You know, copy editing any kind often. That's the other side of peer review, really, where, you know, there was a legitimacy to the Alan Sokol affair with the Social Text, despite the controversy around it. And then predatory publishers, I mean, taking advantage of scholars who are burrowed so deeply in what it is that they're doing that they don't really consider the venue that they're putting their work in. And unfortunately, you know, we're thinking philosophically, if the work is really sound, it shouldn't matter where it's published. It still stands on its own. But that's not how it works. And the reputation of a predatory publisher could be such that it really tarnishes, you know, a scholar's CV. And you don't want that to happen where, you know, your hard work is diminished. And of course, there is value to peer review, you know, taking the good kind of peer review. It helps sharpen argument, helps sharpen a paper, a book, so on and so forth, if it's done right. And of course, with a predatory publisher, that's entirely absent. So, yeah, it's unfortunate that this is, you know, crept into the scholarly communication system like a virus.
Absolutely. And as you're discussing predatory publishers, I'm thinking about how you opened up and talking about publish or perish, right?
Yeah.
And that idea, do you think that concept of publish or perish, that focus on getting X number of articles published each year so that you can go up for tenure or promotion, do you think that's leading to the growth that we see in predatory publishers?
Oh, absolutely, because it's quantity over quality. It's the name of the game, and the high article processing charges that would come with a predatory publisher, or hidden fees, because you're not really paying for anything. You know, there's nothing behind it other than just them raking in the money with no quality check. But yeah, the publisher perish, that definitely makes it so people are perhaps hopping from one project to the next, or within one project, maybe cutting off a slice, often called salami slicing, of a project, and where it's not really that different from what was said in the first article, and just a way to fill out one's CV. It's difficult to blame for a scholar in that position, because that's what's being asked, really. And so a predatory publisher is lying in wait, almost like a spider in a web, looking to trap, you know, unsuspecting scholars who really have their heads down in their own research, as opposed to, you know, assuming that there's somebody out there that's going to do something nefarious with their hard work.
Yeah. Yeah. And now I want to bring it back to Foucault. Now, in your fourth chapter, you're discussing the connection between content and form. And as you mentioned, Foucault's letters were a presentation that was then a lecture that was eventually published. So how does forms like lectures, textbooks, books themselves, essays reflect not only the content, but also the intended audience for that material?
Yeah, it's a... It can be limited, depending one's audience or one's reach can be limited depending on, you know, the format that you use. Something like digital humanities, you know, isn't fully accepted across all of the academy. And so you may do an amazing digital humanities project and it may not be deemed to be worthy for certain scholars. However, you should keep pushing through that, because that's part of what I get at in the chapter, is that we should think through the forms that we use to communicate our ideas. And when I discuss Theodor Adorno's essays, that's very much at the heart of it, or even Jacques Derrida's books, where if you look at his book Glass, it is almost a Mobius strip folding in on itself. There's no real beginning, there's no real end, there's a couple topics. They intertwine. The text has different kinds of font. It's alarming when you open it up. Where do you begin? You know, are you even supposed to read it? Can it be read? Is it a book? So challenging form as well as content and how they work together, I think is really important. So with Foucault's lectures, I think certainly lectures are a form of scholarship, you know, relaying ideas. And who says it can often dictate to certain people whether or not it is scholarship at all. It could be the exact same thing being said, but because a professor says it, it's scholarship. Because a student says it, it's not. I don't think that that's quite accurate. You can be a scholar as a student. But in the case of Foucault's lectures, he Was very much trying to communicate to as many people as possible in the lecture, although he found it very lonely being up there by himself. And so he set up a separate enterprise, which was his seminars, where there could be much more intensive study, there could be dialogue. But I like the spirit of it, which is at the Collège de France, where anyone in the public can come. That's another element to it, which is very much, I think, at the heart of libraries more generally, but open access in particular. Because really, you know, what is a publication? It's supposed to be something accessible to the public, put out for the public to read, as far as scholarship goes. And I think a lot of that has been lost with companies owning and closing off scholarship. You had mentioned closed access a little while ago. That doesn't help the advancement of knowledge. It helps the advancement of a stock price, say, or, you know, a CEO's wallet or bank account, but it doesn't help the advancement of knowledge, which I think is the whole point.
Now, you bring up an interesting point about thinking about who's actually either delivering the lecture, producing the content, right? So if it's a student, it's not given the same level of authority that, say, a faculty member. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about authorship as in terms of, you know, what is an author? What makes an author? How are they a producer?
Yeah. Well, I think this can go back to the encyclopedists who really saw each publication, each article that they wrote, or each attempt to publish something was always a challenge to your credibility. Meaning, just because you wrote, you know, a certain text, tract, whatever, at one point, that doesn't suddenly make you the one who always knows, for certainly not for everything, but in that particular area. I think with faculty members, since, you know, I am one, just because I say something doesn't make it so. That there always needs to be some kind of backing up of that, whether or not it's data, whatever kind of professor one is, or what I like to think is a very scientific way of heavily citing things. And that goes back to Descartes in his book, A Discourse on the Method, where he, I should really directly quote him in order for this to live up to what he said, but I'm going to have to paraphrase. There he says that, don't believe what other people have written about me, believe my words. And so behind that, the citing things, the scientific element of the humanist or social science pursuit, there's some credibility behind that. And so in the classroom or lectures such as Foucault's, there was always something behind that where he would reference specific texts, not just say something just because, which is kind of ironic because that's what he does in his books a lot of the time, is that he just kind of goes and doesn't always cite his sources, but he's much better at that in his lectures. And it's funny because some would see the lectures as not being scholarship in the same way as the books. I see them as all scholarship, and he's actually a lot more careful at times in the lectures than he is in his books.
Now, in your fourth chapter, in your fifth chapter, you're talking about how libraries and archives help facilitate the production and consumption of scholarship. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that they very much give scholarship a second life or a first life, depending on how you see it. So the second life comes from Walter Benjamin, a German scholar in the early 20th century affiliated with the Frankfurt School. And he referred to translations as a way to give something a second life. And I think that libraries and archives do that as well. And that a book or article or archival document may be lying in wait for someone at some point, at some time. And a connection could be made decades later where there's a discovery of some kind. And so they help facilitate that. But then there's the other side where there's space constraints, budget constraints, where you can only have so much stuff. And so weeding comes into it. And that's where there's the possibility of things that could be a great connection, a great bit of knowledge for someone at some point. They're taken away because they haven't been used in the last, say, 10 years. And I think of what I wrote in the conclusion, but it's applicable here. Theodore Adorno's concept of a message in a bottle, which that's how he saw his critical theory, that it may not have applicability to his own time, but somewhere down the road, somebody else will pick up that message in a bottle and do something with it, either theoretically or practically, for the betterment of society. And I think that's always a danger with weeding, that also as an author, it's tough to have your book considered as a type of weed, an unwanted plant, right? But so it goes. That's part of the challenge. I always think that librarians ought to ask for more funding. It's an easy thing to say, but it's an important thing to say, and not just accept the budgets that are given, because this is always deemed to be the heart of the university. And, you know, what happens if you have a bad heart? It's not a good life. So you can see at various universities, certain buildings popping up, say for sciences, or, well, it's typically sciences, engineering, say whatever, all kinds of funding for certain areas, but the libraries don't always get the same kind of funding. And I think there needs to be some kind of shift in the thinking around what deserves funding. And with the library, that's the interdisciplinary space par excellence. And so everything kind of flows through there, whether somebody knows it or not, if they're just accessing it through an online catalog and they don't think that's the library, that is the library. So yeah, they play an absolutely vital role in the beginning, middle, end process of any scholarly communication endeavor. So where does all the material come from that you use for a book? I know where mine came from, either my own personal library or the one I work at, or in interlibraries, or the ones that are online in a way, the open access materials. So yeah, libraries deserve a lot more credit for what it is that they do as far as their role in enlightening people. Yeah.
Yeah, and I really like that you use the term space to talk about it, because oftentimes that's the problem we're having, is that it's valuable space in the heart of the campus. And so oftentimes it's, well, why are we housing all these books that, you know, the perception is students just aren't reading?
Yeah.
and I agree with you. It's troubling to think that we're going to be weeding something that could have value to a scholar down the road. And, you know, how do we combat that? And, you know, it, frankly, is the digital environment just exacerbating this problem, because it's, everybody views it as it's just online. Let's go online.
Right. And of course, that's not the case at all. Not everything is available. Yeah, not at all. But I think it can go backwards, because when I was talking about the Enlightenment at the beginning, and that's how my book kind of begins, and then I move all the way to libraries and archives, instead of putting that all on libraries and archives, you know, you go back to say middle stage in that process of peer review, as you mentioned before. If peer review were reworked and made better, then there wouldn't be as, say, questionable material going through the scholarly communication ecosystem. Something like publish or perish, if there isn't an emphasis on quantity over quality, then there aren't as many books there taking up the space. Yeah, I think a lot can be done, and there's an interconnectedness to it, that this problem isn't just a library problem, although it's treated that way a lot of the time, and it's just dumped on librarians and archivists, that administrators need to take some ownership over this as well. Peer reviewers, publishers need to take some ownership of this, and so on.
I really like what you're saying there because it really resonated with me that if we improve the peer review process, if we address publisher perish, it will address the space limitations that we often have, which leads to weeding our collections. And, you know, I guess, does it all come down to tenure? Do we have to rethink tenure requirements in terms of what's being published, how it's being published? Should more value be placed on open access materials through that process to kind of facilitate that movement? And would that then address predatory journals?
Yeah, it's tricky because, you know, tenure is at the beginning. There's a push, a career. There's a push to, you know, do something right away. It's got to be done. But there could be a shift with, and I think there is in certain places, the emphasis on publications as paramount to everything. That maybe there's more of a shift towards teaching for an excellent teacher, lecturer, so on and so forth. They get to have their craft appreciated in a way that it may not be in a particular tenure process. Now, I say that there are professor positions out there that are teaching heavy or focused entirely. And so they would get their credit for their teaching activities in a position like that. But I think it shouldn't be restricted to that, just a specialization over here. These are the professors who teach, these are the ones who research, but across the board, there can be some recognition of what's really important. I think if you can make the difference in a student or two's life, like really make a difference in their life by teaching them something or by advising them, that's worth a lot more than a book that's gonna get weeded from a stack.
Very true. Absolutely. I have to, you know, Patrick, I know we're taking up a lot of your time. And as we wrap up our time together, you know, I want to see, what else are you working on? Are you continuing along this thread, or are you going to move in a different direction with your research?
Yes, I am in a different direction right now. I'm just putting the finishing touches on my third book, which is The Dialectic of Herbert Marcuse. I don't think I mentioned him at all in the book we're talking about. When I was at Brandeis, I was a librarian there. Herbert Marcuse, he's part of the Frankfurt School, critical theory. Some people would know who he is. Anyway, he was a faculty member at Brandeis in the late 50s and 60s. And this was probably about 10 years ago. It was about to be the 50th anniversary of the publication of his most famous book, One Dimensional Man. And I remember looking around thinking, we got to celebrate this. And there wasn't a lot of material known there. Long story short, working with some of the archivists there, I was able to find an early draft of his book, One Dimensional Man, that had been stored offsite at Harvard. And we brought in. It's amazing because it's a book in a box marked with an X, just like pirate treasure. X marks the spot. There it was. So he had gifted the first draft of the manuscript to Brandeis. From there, I started teaching in the History of Ideas program, just like he did, so on and so forth. But anyway, that project of remembering Herbert Marcuse has been with me since then. And so I just... tomorrow, I think I'll finish the first draft of my book and send it back to the publisher on his work and talking about the manuscript and a lot of his other, you know, critical theory. So that's what I've been working on. And then I have another book in the works on Henri Lefebvre, who is the topic of my first book, Henri Lefebvre, Boredom in Everyday Life. This one, which I guess I'll start on Monday. I'll take a break for Super Bowl Sunday, and then Monday I'll start this other book on Lefebvre, his meta-philosophy. He called himself a meta-philosopher, especially later in his career. This book is really about looking into what is it that made him a meta-philosopher, and why was it so important to him, and why has no one really recognized that that's at the core of what he was as a scholar. So those two books, that's what I'm working on right now. Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad we get to talk to you today and that you're finishing up your third book. Hopefully you come back and join us again when that gets gets published. And, your fourth book sounds very interesting. Do you have any time to rest with all these projects going on?
Yeah. My wife is very patient, and I love her very much for letting me do this kind of thing on weekends or evenings. But I definitely need to halt the book publication process, because that will be my fourth book in 4 years. And so I could probably take a break from that. Yeah.
a well-deserved break. Well, Patrick, I want to thank you for your time today. I really enjoyed this conversation. I actually really enjoyed your book. And I just want to say I'm your host, Michael Lamagna, and thank you for listening to the New Books in Library Science podcast channel on the New Books Network.